Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
These were the folks who finally tried it. A few dozen running toward an entrance of Area 51, the secretive military base in Nevada, said to be holding clues to alien life forms. A Facebook hoax this summer invited people to storm Area 51 on September 20th. Since Thursday, five people have been arrested. Mostly
it's 2019, and this group of kind of douchey internet influencers or whatever, what they needed to do was crash the gates of Area 51. Now, this is a military base. Just look it up if you haven't heard of it, in the heart of the Nevada desert. It's used for weapons testing and secret aircraft testing. And it's at the heart of any number of conspiracy theories around UFOs, aliens, and a bunch more stuff. For decades, folks passionate about this type of thing wanted to take a look around in there and get to the bottom of it. And now, in this year of 2019, it looks like it's actually going to happen. Their plan is simple. You get enough crazy people, young people, and you amass them at the gates, and then you just charge your way in. Now, I just want to say this is a spectacularly terrible idea, right? I mean, the military will protect its secrets with lethal force if it comes to that. But these young men are determined. And then all of a sudden, nothing. Nothing happened. The event's organizers weren't there to get killed breaking into Area 51. They were there for clicks and engagement, and nothing ever came of it. Kind of to the dismay of the UFO enthusiasts around the world. But here's the thing, Joe. There was this one guy, and he wasn't there in 2019. He went to Area 51 in 1997, and he wasn't there to explore alien conspiracies. But here's what he did do. He broke into Area 51, and he stayed inside there for an entire week. We're going to tell his story, and it may, just maybe, change what you think about this place. So today, we're bringing you the account of one Mr. Jerry Freeman.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni, this is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. Hope you enjoyed that little lead-in. And this is a very shocking story, by the way, the story of Jerry Freeman. But first, let me introduce our cast. It's me, Joe. And over there in the other corner is...
Vincent Caldoni.
All right. And of course, Jerry Freeman, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But he did document his fascinating little tale of what he did when he snuck onto Nellis Air Force Base, which is where Area 51 is. It's a massive, it's not just, you know, you think of a base, it's not just a little base. It's a massive, massive tract of desert and mountains and valleys and all sorts of stuff. Very inhospitable country. Kind of northwest of Las Vegas. And definitely no man's land. It's like, you know, right next door to good old Death Valley, by the way, which you may have heard of too. Slightly more hospitable than Death Valley, but not much.
Not by a lot.
Yeah, so we're gonna start off with the premise that you guys have an understanding of what Area 51 is. And if you don't, just maybe go look it up. But a quick version of it is that it's located in, as we said, one of the most remote and inhospitable areas in the continental U.S. It's been the site of many tests of secret planes and weapons, like, you know, think the stealth fighter, the F-117, and the UT spy plane way back in the day. It's ultra top secret in nature. And of course, it's got some association with events like the Roswell, New Mexico crash. Some people believe that there was a UFO that crashed, and it's being stored right now. The wreckage of it is being stored at Area 51. and I'm sure that's true. But so there is a pop culture fascination with this place. There's been movies and TV shows made about it, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a fun place. I want to go. Probably won't.
So this brings us to Jerry Freeman. And I think it's so crazy that Jerry Freeman seems to be the only civilian who's credibly breached security at Area 51.
Well, no, he's not the only one, I'm sure. He's the only one that made it back out.
Well, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Right. He's the only one who managed to do this, and he didn't just do it. He evaded capture for 7 full days. He spent 7 full days within Area 51.
Or at least close to it. And I don't know, they spent the whole 7 days inside Area 51, actually. Because it's actually, I mean, Nellis Air Force Base is enormous. And then Area 51 is a smaller area inside there around the Groom Lake area.
That's true.
So, yeah. So a lot of his journey to get there, he couldn't just drive. You can't just drive up to Area 51.
No, that's
if
true.
If you're a civilian. So he had to drive up somewhere, I don't know, 35, 40 miles away and sort of hoof it the rest of the way. So
you're technically correct, but I think most people would say once you hit that fence, you're basically at Area 51. But you are correct. He was at Nellis, and then he had to hike into the area that's Area 51.
And you're definitely trespassing. Even if you haven't quite made it to Area 51, you're still in a place that you're not supposed to be.
Oh, you're in big trouble. They catch you beyond that fence.
Yeah, they would, yeah.
But as we said, Freeman, this guy Jerry Freeman, he wasn't some UFO nut. He wasn't there to define UFO conspiracies. He was a historian.
Yeah, and I guess an amateur. I think he had a degree in archaeology.
I think so. I think his degree is in archaeology. I've never actually tracked down directly what he studied. I know he doesn't carry a title. Like, he's not Dr. Jerry Freeman. But yeah, I believe he had a degree in something like archaeology and anthropology.
But he was working, I believe, as a teacher when he made his little trek.
That's true.
He had been kind of obsessing about the 49ers, the lost 49ers, who we'll tell you about in a minute. Mm-hmm. When he decided to do this. Sounds like quite the little adventure, but he was 55 years old. This was April 1997 when he decided to make his dangerous little journey. And even though he was 55, you know, he's like me, you know, I'm older too, but I'm tough as nails, you know. But he was an experienced outdoorsman and adventurer type. And his area of focus, as we mentioned, his obsession was around the fate of this lost group of settler, pioneer, prospector types who were known as the Lost 49ers, also called the Death Valley 49ers. They became lost in the Nevada desert, which was unfortunate for them. And a lot of their history has been lost due to lax documentation. But it's said that their artifacts and, you know, possibly papers, diaries, God knows what, they're sitting out in the desert. And they just have not yet been discovered. They're waiting to be discovered. But unfortunately, a lot of that stuff, their past took them to what is today a top secret military base. And so I guess it cuts both ways, because reports from prior to the 1950s show that many of these sites, which were found, that were intact. And so that's the good news is that if the military has secured this, then those sites are sitting out there untouched. That's a good thing.
Right.
The bad news, of course, is that, you can't actually go out there yourself and look at them because the military won't let you. So,
nope.
Yeah.
And Freeman, he was no dummy. Like, he knew this was risky. So what he did, this is pretty cool. He contacted a newspaper called the Las Vegas Sun, and he coordinated daily secret check-ins with them so that if he were picked up, someone would know where he was and he could get that information back to the public. Which might prevent the possibility of a permanent disappearance, and at the very least would leave some record of what he had seen and done there.
And he told the Sun, by the way, and here's a quote from the Sun, quote, "I am not interested in the military or technology. I'm interested purely in the history and culture of that site and its artifacts. I'm an archaeologist. That's all I am," unquote. So he was not an Area 51 obsessive by any means.
He was not there to look at advanced military technology or to have a pool party with ET. So why did he want to get in there? This is the reason. In 1849, there's a bunch of, they call them 49ers. They were gold prospectors, and they got lost out there due to getting a bad map got a lot to do with it.
And some bad advice.
And some bad advice. And they had some bad ideas in their own head. It, failure has many mothers. Their incredible determination managed to keep their expedition from being a desert Donner Party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the one thing you can say for these guys. They didn't wind up eating each other. That's good. That's a plus. Still, they had a rough time of it. Still.
This was not good.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. Let's get into what the 49ers, the Death Valley 49ers went through.
Well, first of all, what is a 49er? Well, it's because there was news of this big gold strike in California. So there was this big mad rush of people across the continent to go there and, and strike it rich themselves. And because the year was 1849, all these people came to be called 49ers, all these people that traveled across the country to go to California.
Interestingly enough, Joe, very few of them actually were traveling there in 1849.
But they're still 49ers because that's when they got the idea.
The gold was discovered in 1949, which is why we call them 49ers.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so if you're wondering where that term came from, 49ers, that's where it came from. So they made the trip across America by covered wagon and to get a piece of the California gold rush. And long story short, these guys were headed out of Salt Lake City towards California. And a crummy map was brought to their attention by some dude who just rode into their camp one day. And I don't know what this guy was up to, if he was for real or if he was just a sociopath who wanted to, mess with these people. But he had a map and a story about a shortcut that could cut as much as 500 miles off their trip. And so that sounds pretty awesome to me. Yeah. But, that's a little too good to be true, frankly.
Yeah, because remember, generally, you didn't ride in the wagon pulled by the oxen, right? You'd be walking alongside it. So this is 500 miles of desert walking. This man is credibly offering them. You can see why you'd be tempted to believe what he's saying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But it was too good to be true. They wound up, unfortunately, in some of the least forgiving territory in the world. And these guys nearly died. Some of them did die. And and their survival efforts were nothing short of heroic. Although I don't know if they're really heroic. They're just staying alive, but still.
They survived. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, we don't call the guy who's smart enough not to go into the middle of the desert a hero. We call the guy who goes in there and then somehow makes it out and saves a bunch of people a hero.
Yeah, I know.
Right? I don't know why that is, but it's true.
it is true. Yeah, I suppose it's true. You should just say, you're not a hero. You're just a dumbass. but no, sorry. That would be insensitive of me to say.
It's not even that he's a dumbass. None of these people, very few of these people were dumbasses. They were pretty smart, but they made some major mistakes and then made the best of it. How heroic is that? I think even they would be like, yeah, maybe not so much. We probably should have just stuck to the plan and went the way everyone else went.
Yeah, and their guide from Salt Lake City that was going to take them down what was called the Old Spanish Trail that would take them southwest into California. Their guide himself had made one major mistake that caused him to lose some credibility.
This is Jefferson Hunt, by the way.
Jefferson Hunt was the guy's name. And he at one point... forged on ahead to scout out a path that he believed would be a little bit of a shortcut himself. And he failed. He eventually came back in defeat to the wagon train and said, nope, that didn't pan out. So sorry, on we go. And that cost him some credibility with those guys. And that was the kind of situation that this guy came upon when he rode into their camp with this story and this map. Of a shortcut.
Right.
Because they'd lost. Yeah. So that's part of it too. But still, even though Jefferson had maybe screwed up just a bit, they probably should have stuck with him.
But, yeah.
Oh, well. Hindsight is 2020, right?
yeah, very much so. So the story goes, the group was making their way west and they reached the Sierra Nevada mountain range too late to make a crossing without hitting those big old snows. So one of the things you need to know is that the Sierra Nevadas are some of the snowiest places in the continental United States.
Yeah, they catch a lot of moisture coming in off the Pacific, and then it hits that cold air up over the mountains, and then bam. And so, yeah, it is. And they're very rugged mountains, too.
They're steep.
They're beautiful steep, country. They're rugged. Oh, yeah, it's incredible. It's fantastic country. But not so great to cross in the wintertime.
Honestly, even today with automobiles and the American highway system, it's still a dangerous place to try to go through in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And these guys were in ox-drawn wagons, in rutted trails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were in a bit of a pickle trying to get over the Sierra Nevada mountains at this time when all the snow is beginning to accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
And they obviously had a big fear because they were like just 3 years after the Donner Party. I won't go into the Donner Party.
Yeah.
Most people know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't, long story short, they tried to cross the Sierra Nevadas. They got stuck in the snow. They ate each other.
Yeah.
That's what you need to know. They didn't want to end up like that. That was bad.
No, that's, and luckily they didn't, at least, or maybe they did, but they didn't tell us. That could be it too. I don't know, but I think they didn't.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that happened, but yeah, what do we know?
I think that actually, well, food was an issue with these guys, but being in the desert, I think that water was the bigger issue, actually.
Water was a huge issue, and we'll talk about that. So anyway, they didn't want to end up like the Donner Party, and so they decided to make this cut through the desert. Which probably sounded great, but this is very literally a case of one of my favorite quotes, the map is not the terrain.
Yeah, there are sometimes maps can be a little deceptive in that respect. When you get out there and,
In this case, the map was just wrong. But even when the map is correct, I mean, haven't you done this before, Joe? Like been out on a hike and you've got a good map and you're like, yeah, it's cool. I'll just do this. And then you realize, yeah, there are 500 foot elevation gains. And then there are 500 foot elevation gains.
And again, but in these days too, I mean, maps were not as accurate as they are today and not as all encompassing and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean,
there was just no topographical survey of the Western United States at this point.
No,
there were people who had said, there's a desert here about this place and there's a giant canyon here about this place. But like what you were really looking to get into was not what you would actually experience when you were walking it on foot with oxen. And that's what happened. See, their guy, Jefferson Hunt, he had wanted to shorten the shortcut, right? So they were already doing a shortcut. He thought he could cut an additional 500 miles off of it. But the map that he was working off of, which I believe is what this guy in Salt Lake had sold them, it just didn't describe this massive canyon, which you're not going to get an ox-drawn cart down and back up. You probably could actually do it on foot, but you're not going to do it with
cattle. No, that's the problem. That was the carts. I think the river, the canyon was a part of, was on the map. And so, hey, that's easy. We can ford that.
Get across it, go around it, do whatever.
The river sank. What the hell? Right. The river's 100 feet lower. What happened?
Right. Yeah. It just wasn't a great map. And that's understandable given the technology and the time and how remote these places were. They still are remote. But it screwed them over, and they were on too thin a margin to live like that, to be able to do that.
Yeah, they didn't have they were bringing pretty much all their supplies with them, and there was no game to shoot. At least, I mean, out there in the desert, or very little of it and everything. So,
you might get a hare or two, but there's just not much out there.
And there wasn't much in the way of vegetation for their oxen to eat. So
there's that. And then the other issue you have is water, and we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
The team found, by the time the team had found out their mistake, they were already 7 days off of the trail that they were originally trying to take, which itself was a bold and dangerous diversion from the original trail. So that's 7 days of supplies, 7 days of animal exhaustion, 7 days of water. I mean, they must have just soiled themselves when they rocked up on that canyon.
Oh yeah, no, it's I'm sure that was a common experience back in those days. It's
the heartbreak, right?
Happens in these days too. So I guess roughly half the group wanted to turn around and head back to the original trail. That would be the Spanish trail, which, and then the other half wanted to just double down on the whole experience and look for another way around the canyon. And so they split up. And then the group that decided to look for somewhere around the canyon was, they were ultimately rewarded with a way around the canyon and some fresh water, but not quite. They did actually cut a little distance off the trip, but they ended up in the middle of frigging nowhere near Groom Lake, Nevada, which is now the area of Area 51.
It is,
Groom
yes.
Lake. Groom Lake is, by the way, not a beautiful lake. It's a dry lake bed. Might get an inch or two of water in it in the wintertime when it rains, but the rest of the time it's just dry. So that's the kind of lake we're talking about.
Right. Today. So we're talking about a desert lake from Looney Tunes, dry, cracked sand.
Yeah.
You're wandering over.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's a lot of those lakes around the American West. We've even got a few here, right here in Oregon.
Absolutely. The Alvord Desert, one of my favorite places to visit.
I love the Alvord. It's an awesome place.
Amazing. Isn't it cool out there?
It's very cool. I love that part of the state. By the way, statistically speaking, that is the most empty part of the lower continental 48 states.
Absolutely. And you know, for population,
it is the least populated area in the lower 48, and which is one of the reasons I like it. It's a great place to go to get away from people. And by the way, if you're listening to this, forget you ever heard that, because I don't want people coming out there and cluttering up the place. Okay, don't even think about that. But anyway, so they're at Groom Lake, which is a dry lake bed, just a big sandy, flat, huge expanse, no shelter, lots and lots of wind. I've not been on Groom Lake, but I've been on other dry lake beds in Nevada, and they get very windy. They heinous dust storms get kicked up.
I mean, I've been hit by a man in California, getting rolled over by one of those little sandstorm. I guess they're not technically a sandstorm, but like those dust storms that kick
It's more brutal, like, man. Yeah, it's more like it's a dust storm. It's like the surface of these things gets kind of like turns into this powder, like talcum powder almost.
Yeah.
And when these dust storms get kicked up, this crap gets into everything. It gets in there, every crack and orifice in your body and in your car and in all your gear. And God.
Oh, and you're just choking on it. Like, I just remember wrapping a wet t-shirt around my face just to try to keep the crap out of my nose and my mouth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's really intense.
It's actually worse than sand. It's harder to keep out of your mouth and your nostrils than sand is. And so it's nasty stuff. But anyway, so what do we got here? So you say the group split in two. Does this mean that this is another split, or are you referring
to the second group has now split in two.
Oh, so now they split in two at Groom Lake, correct?
Yeah, so the guys who made it to Groom Lake have split in two again. And I don't know how many men were in these groups, but I think this is pretty small. I think this is like 3-4 guys a pop. But I don't know. I don't have the numbers on that. Sorry, Joe. I don't. Okay. But these are really small groups of just a few guys.
I just wasn't sure if you were repeating yourself or if this is a new split.
So. No, it's a new split. So now there are technically four groups out. One group decided they were going to do the exact thing they were trying to avoid, and they were going to get out of that desert by heading into those snowy mountains.
Yeah.
The other group trudged on through the desert.
Exactly. If I was out there dying of thirst in the desert, those snowy mountains would look kind of good. Although that's deceptive, obviously. Yeah.
I mean, that's what you got to understand. There's not many places on Earth like this. You're in the desert. You're looking up at these snow-capped peaks, and you're thinking, thank God I can get up there. That snow means there's water. It means that it's cool.
Yeah.
But that's as the Donner Party learned, that can be a big, out of the pot and into the pan kind of scenario.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So on they went.
On they went.
Again. Yeah.
So long story short, to abridge a bunch of it, both plans actually kind of worked. There were losses, but the two groups reunited on Christmas Eve of 1849. And finally, they got something to drink as the snow was setting in. But that's a double-edged sword, right?
Remember we talked about course.
The Donner Party? Right? Yeah. So they ended up right where they didn't want to be. These men, seeing the oncoming snow and knowing that the window was closing, there'd be, I don't know, 6-8 feet of snow any day now. They made a bold and extremely desperate decision. They abandoned their wagons, all of their worldly possessions. They slaughtered their oxen.
Oh, jerks. I mean, those oxen, that's a fine thank you. The oxen pulled them and their crappy wagons and possessions all the way across the continent. And and then they get killed and turned into jerky.
That's what they did. They turned them into jerky.
Seriously. Yeah.
And they basically ditched everything they had. And with that little bit of meat from their oxen, set out on foot. They're only taking what they can carry on their bodies in this desperate scramble to get to California. But this gambit, as crazy as it was, it paid off. They reached California, two groups, starved and frostbitten, but alive. So these men went from dying of dehydration in the desert to nearly freezing to death in the mountains, and they made it.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is they're dead broke. All the stuff they brought with them to try to set up a mining operation, their hopes of striking it rich, it's basically all dashed.
Yeah, they were screwed.
Now, you remember the guys that turned back that didn't want to go around the canyon?
Yeah.
They didn't get so lucky. They didn't find water, unlike the guys who did try to go around the canyon. By the time the first group made it back to the trail, they'd lost so much time that the pass to California over this place called the Panamint Mountains, which sits sort of at the base near what you would call the Sierra Nevadas, it was totally snowed over. That meant they were totally forced to spend the winter in the desert, and they had not the supplies for that.
Yeah, they really should have just stuck to the old Spanish trail and, not deviated. But so what do we have here? A couple of men from that group actually left to scout forward over the pass, right?
Mm-hmm.
They barely made it over the pass into the end of the trail, and there they ran into the lucky idiots who had made it over going the other direction. So that was cool, and that was lucky. And together, they all decided to like raise a community effort among all the other people.
Right. So like a 19th century GoFundMe page.
Yeah, kind of like that. So they wanted to go back and find the team that was stuck out there without supplies, trying to survive the winter and headed towards Donnerism probably. So they wanted to get out there before this happened, which just seems reasonable, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So after a journey of 300 snowy high altitude miles back down into Nevada, these would-be heroes appeared with nothing. They got back to the other group and they had nothing but a couple of horses and some really basic supplies to make the trip back with. So things are now again extremely desperate. Some of the people had actually abandoned Hunt's party and tried to scramble over the mountains, and they're lost to history. Presumably they got real dead real fast because we have no idea to this day where they ended up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, bear bait, no doubt.
But our intrepid rescuers found two families starving out there in the desert. Yeah, these are families. It was the families that stayed behind because they had kids.
Yeah.
The single men, they were the ones that took off in this mad scramble to get over the mountains.
Yeah. Well,
out there with your kids.
Yeah.
Waiting to either bake or starve to death. Yeah, bad scene. So together, the rescuers and the members of the two families did everything in their powers to make it back over that pass. But quickly, they ran out of supplies again. This is everything they were trying to avoid. They end up on the same friggin' mountains as the Donner Party.
I know, right?
And trapped in the same snow. But then the rescue comes. Yeah. From real honest to God cowboys.
Yeah. John Wayne.
These were not some John Wayne looking dudes. These were Spanish speaking Californios. So they would be sort of ethnic mestizo. We'd probably call them Mexican today.
Yeah.
And these men and their horses rescued the rescuers and their party. They saved them. They got them down into California alive, including the kids. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, yeah. So what was the total butcher's bill on this one?
In total, 13 people lost their lives.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
This shortcut that was supposed to save them 500 miles and I think 3 months of travel cost them over 6 months and basically everything everyone on the ride had.
Yeah.
They ended up in California with nothing.
Yeah. It's a shame, you know, because, yeah, like I said, even the guys that went back and stuck to the Spanish trail, if they hadn't wasted time in the shortcut, they probably would have been okay. But here's an interesting little factoid for you. When they were leaving the area, one of the fathers of the two families that had been rescued said aloud, "Goodbye, Death Valley." And it wasn't called Death Valley then, but it's been called Death Valley ever since.
Yeah.
That's how it got its name. Now this is and the reason we're telling you this whole backstory is so you can understand the fascination that some people might have for these people and for reconstructing the history of what happened on this whole thing. Anything?
Well, as an American student, I learned about the Donner Party. Did you?
No, we didn't talk about such thing.
Oh, really?
No, actually, no. We did. I remember learning about it. I don't remember if we talked about it in school or where exactly I heard about it. You know, maybe on the playground. We heard about the Donner Party. Everybody's heard of it. I assume they still talk about it in school.
Yeah, I think it's more famous than ever. But I would be curious to know. And feel free to write us an email and let me know. I think most people in America who are at least kind of up on this stuff have some idea who the Donner Party were.
But the Lost 49ers, that's a different story.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You don't study in school the Death Valley guys who should have got a better map.
No. Like,
that's not really a thing, not a chapter in your sophomore history.
Yeah. But yeah, this was basically like the Donner Party, just without cannibalism.
Well, in some ways, I can see why Jerry Freeman, who was just obsessed with the Death Valley 49ers, why he thinks this is an American story that should be told. It's kind of a better story than the Donner Party in a lot of ways.
It's a little more gruesome. Uplifting. Yeah. And actually, he'd done a lot of he'd gotten groups of students and fellow archaeologists together and actually traced the root of these guys. Mm-hmm. Quite, you know, just about all of it right up to the, you now, the boundaries of the Nellis Air Force Base, and found, you know, and actually found some artifacts and such from the party. And so he was kind of obsessed with, you know, being able to trace the entire route and thinking about all the possibilities of finding things like, you know, like not just, you know, odds and ends and artifacts, but maybe finding some letters and journals and things like that, which would have been from a historical perspective, a pretty huge deal. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And of course they would be probably fairly well preserved out there in the desert air. Right.
Right. So, well, the main thing that Jerry really wanted to look for was a series of cabins that they'd built out of rock that he believed would still be standing. They'd certainly been standing up till sometime around the 1930s, and then some inscriptions in the rock, which were reported up until between the 1930s and the 1950s, but had not been seen since because of Area 51.
Yeah, they were apparently like along their trail, they left seven of those inscriptions as like kind of way markers. And, and I think Jerry had managed to find all but one of those. And but there was
well,
one.
Jerry and other people. Jerry didn't discover.
Well, yeah, that's
the
true.
Six. He'd either retraced ones that other people had found, or there's one I believe that he was able to locate himself.
Yeah, I think no, you're right. That is correct. But then there was one elusive one that somebody had actually photographed way, way back when in the day.
Yeah, the 30s, I believe.
The 1930s, I think. And but he wanted to go like check it out for himself.
But before we get into that, I think we need to take a brief word from our Magnited sponsors.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, everybody wants to hear from our sponsors. They're much more exciting than we are.
right?
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, we'll be right back.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. I hope you enjoyed the commercials. Where were we? We were talking about Jerry Freeman and his obsession with tracing the entire route, and especially getting a look at that one last carved symbol in the rocks, you know, that marked their path. And he really wanted to get in there, and it seems reasonable enough to really let him in there, you know, don't you think? He kept asking for access just to go in there and look around. He even offered to go in blindfolded if that's what they wanted, you know. But they just kept. And actually, like the BLM and everybody else that was had a say in that stuff was okay, but the Air Force was just, they were kind of wet blankets about the whole thing, and they just kept saying, "Nope, you ain't getting in there." So what did he do?
He retired and he took up fishing.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, but. I'm kidding.
This absolute legend, Jerry Freeman, decided to break into the base and retrace the party's steps.
Yeah, without the dying part. Yeah.
You see, the routes were pretty meticulously recorded in the pioneers' journals, which were preserved but were never published. Jerry basically managed to commit these routes to memory. Are you getting the vibe that Freeman is like a little obsessed here? Because he was.
Well, in that part of California and Nevada, this story is a little bit bigger in people's minds than it is in the rest of the country, too. They always bear that in mind, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So he knew, as we said, he knew that the lost 49ers had made seven inscriptions along the way to mark their passage. And he wanted to track down that final missing one that he had not actually personally laid eyes on yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the exact location of it was not precisely documented prior to the area becoming closed off because it became a military base. So, but it was made in 1849 by one of the lost settlers. Journals said it was located on one of the walls of Nye Canyon, which is a pretty large geographical area to go search, frankly.
Right, yeah.
It is. Yeah, unfortunately for him, it's not some skinny little canyon. It's a very wide canyon, kind of like a wash, really, wide, shallow canyon.
This obviously was not Freeman's first rodeo. 1 year earlier, in 1996, he led five people across 330 miles of the original route, and that took them about 32 days. It's a pretty intense trek they made.
Yeah.
The crew had managed to find one of the seven elusive settler rock inscriptions. That is one that had remained lost. And actually, they had discovered it. They were the first to document it with photographs.
That's pretty cool.
No, it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was still one left. Back in the 30s, someone had gotten a photo of it. It's not a very good photo. I found it on the internet. It's hard to see.
Yeah.
Ever since, no one had ever even seen it. Even more perplexing was its exact location had been lost to time. I don't know who was out there taking pictures of this inscription, but they didn't record exactly where they were. So Freeman felt like he had to go. He had to see it. He had to take a picture.
Yeah.
So he starts by asking permission. National Park Service, they thought the idea was cool. The Bureau of Land Management, they were receptive. The Department of Energy agreed.
Yeah.
The Air Force gave Freeman access no other historian had ever been granted. They would not let him go down near Groom and Papoose Lakes. Again, not Holly Lakes.
Yeah.
Even the late Senator Harry Reid couldn't talk the military into it. This is literally as top secret as any piece of real estate in the U.S. can be.
Yeah, it's and of course, he didn't really need to see necessarily Groom Lake, but Papoose Lake, he kind of needed to get into that area because that's roughly that is essentially Nye Valley, and or at least a part of Nye Valley. So that's where the inscription would have been, most likely. In fact, yeah. I think it was noted that it was next to Papoose Lake in one of those journals. So that's the part he needed to see. And that supposedly is not a classified site quite so much as Groom Lake, which, of course, is, again, where Area 51 is. So
if you look at
like, say, Google Aerial, and you look for Groom Lake, you can see the Area 51 base there to the southwest, on the southwest edge of the lake, and right up against that is to the southwest, kind of, there's a brown oval of hills or mountains, however you would describe them. And then Papoose Lake is on the other side of that from Groom Lake. So in theory, if they took him in there and let him loose in the Papoose Lake area to look around, that would have not been a problem. I mean, the mountains would have blocked any view that he would have had of Area 51, right? And yet they wouldn't let, and this, by the way, plays into some theories that there are people out there who have a theory about an extra Area 51, Area 52.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which some people claim is Papoose Lake. So, and I'm not endorsing this theory necessarily, but this would tend to support the idea when you think about it. Of course, at the same time, another argument for the Air Force not letting him near Papoose Lake would be just, well, our top secret fighter jet that we happen to be working on right now has to go out for a test flight. It's probably going to fly around and probably fly over Papoose Lake, and then he'll get a look at it, and we'll have to kill him. So maybe, So maybe that's why Papoose Lake was considered off limits.
I think it's, honestly, Joe, I think it's more bureaucratic than that.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth. Yeah, nobody ever lost his job by just saying no,
Yeah, not really, right?
Yeah, and keeping the secret, right? Yeah, so that probably is. Yeah, it's the bureaucratic imperative here. Yeah.
They don't want to set a precedent, right?
Yeah.
It's okay. He's just a historian who wants to take a picture of a rock carving.
Yeah.
They're like, no, here's how this level of secrecy works. No one gets in for any reason.
Yeah.
Change that once, we could all be in a bunch of trouble. So let's just never, ever change it. Let's just not ever be like, well, we made an exception for this one guy. So then the next time a guy comes around, we don't have to say, who let this guy in and why was he let in? No, we just don't do it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, really what it came down to. I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
That's probably it. But of course, our buddy Freeman, John, this did not deter him.
Not at all.
No, not at all. He didn't get on YouTube and try to muster up a crowd to go charge the gates or anything like that. But, besides being an archaeologist and a scholar, he was a desert rat. The guy had spent a lot of time in the desert, and he probably knew the area around that base better than the military did. And
honestly, that's not an exaggeration. I think he really did.
And he knew the consequences of screwing up out there, but he also knew how to take care of himself too. Right. And of course, he also knew that if he got caught, well, he'd probably be in a world of hurt, and who knows, maybe he'd even get killed. I mean,
legally, you can shoot a man on a military base like this.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah.
This is part of why the whole Area 51 base charge thing in 2019 was so controversial, and so many people thought it might end really terribly.
Yeah.
Because it didn't, because it was just nonsense.
Yeah.
But yeah.
They were just lacking people, hotheads in the crowd that, got the crowd whipped up to charge the gates. And probably the gates were, fairly stout too, I'm wagering. But on top of that, if they don't kill you, which they probably won't, frankly, you can go to prison for a long time for trespassing in a sensitive area like this. If they want it. If they decide not to take mercy on you, they can probably lock you up for life even.
I tried to get a sense of this, like, if Freeman had been caught, what would they charge him with? Mm-hmm. And it really ranges on what they said, but it wouldn't have been good.
Probably not.
I'm pretty sure at 55 years old, Jerry Freeman would not have seen freedom in his life if he'd been caught by these guys.
Yeah, or either that, or they would take mercy and let him out when he's like 85. Yeah, big whoop. at that point,
a lot of these sentences have minimums that are way less than 30 years.
But if they let you out at 85, what are you going to do with the remaining several years of your life? That sucks. You might as well keep me in prison. At least I've got a place to sleep in three squares, right? But that was the thing nagging Jerry, was that if he got caught, like supposing he achieved his objective, he found the inscription and he actually got photos of it. But then he gets busted, it would all be gone, to be lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was his idea? He decided he'd get in touch with a reporter from The Sun in Las Vegas. And I guess, I don't know who actually paid for it, who supplied him with the high-tech phone. I don't know if it was a satellite phone or what.
So, I've actually looked into this, and I don't want to get us down some weird, boring rabbit hole.
Yeah.
It seems like it had to be a satellite phone.
Yeah.
But no contemporary reporting at the time specifies what technology he was using.
Mm-hmm.
What I do know is you couldn't make a cell phone call from Area 51 in 1997.
No.
And so I think it would have had to have been a satellite phone. It would have been the only tech available at the time that was going to reliably work in a place like that.
Yeah. So he had I don't know who, if he paid for it or if the paper did, but so that the idea of he was going to send text messages and maybe verbal reports too, I don't know, to the reporter there at the Sun in real time. So that way, if he was caught, then at least they would have some information about, you know, what he'd done and what he'd discovered, right? You know,
right? Yeah. If they caught him, what would be available to the public would be up to at least the most recent text he'd sent, right?
Yeah. So that's a bold plan. I don't know. And I don't know too. I mean, that probably would add a few years to your sentence too, because it's not bad enough that you were there, but you actually got information out of this secret place to somebody else. You know,
that would piss the government off. But I do see the wisdom in this, and that he gets to say it'll be harder for him to just disappear.
Mm.
Which, well, I would be worried about that, right? That they would catch me, they'd take me to some room, and then no one would ever hear from me again. And they're going to go, I don't know, maybe you just died out there.
Yeah. They probably wouldn't do that. They probably would just, wouldn't say any room. They'd probably ship you off to the Egyptians or the Jordanians, who would torture you the hell out of you just to make sure you're not holding back any secrets. But but the intention here was to map areas within the secret base and share it with the press. And so that probably would definitely be considered some sort of federal offense, right? You're mapping an area within a secret base, because he was planning on drawing a map to this symbol out there.
Right.
Yeah. So let's see what. So
I wouldn't do it. I'm not going to lie. It's,
yeah.
As cool as I think the story of these lost 49ers in Death Valley were, wouldn't risk.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of where I would be too. I think that it's well documented enough, in my opinion, that he didn't need to go out there and risk his life and his freedom to maybe pick up a few more nuggets of information about what these people did. You know, he was obsessed, and I don't know. There's just better things to be obsessed about, in my humble opinion. But still, I'm not putting him down. It's like, it's cool that he went out and had this little adventure.
I respect his dedication. I'm going to say that.
Oh yeah, no, and it was it just took some hardiness to go out there and on foot, you know, traveling miles in the blazing desert sun, you know? So, yeah. So his first note or publication or whatever in the Vegas Sun was from April 22nd, 1997. Yeah. Quote, in a dramatic voice. Okay. Here we go. Okay. Quote, I stood alone beside the rusted metal barricade marking the end of public land. An hour earlier, I watched my brother's car disappear down a faint desert track high in Nevada's Spectre Range, unquote. And Spectre Range, by the way, that's kind of on the south side of like the southwest side of Nellis Air Force Base. So he's talking now about crossing over, not in Area 51, but into Nellis Air Force Base, which is good.
Right, which is the area that's completely sealed off and protected. So while you're not technically in Area 51, I think most lay people would be like, yeah, it's where Area 51 starts.
It's where it starts. It's like it's within that, and there's a lot of other stuff going on in there besides. It's, you know, there's bombing ranges and, you know, testing ranges, and there's also a big valley to the west of Papoose Lake. A decent sized valley there where they tested a lot of atomic and nuclear bombs.
Absolutely,
and if you look at it on Google Aerial, you can see it there. It's pockmarked. There's a lot of craters here, big craters from those nuclear tests. And so all kinds of stuff has happened in that area. So, yeah, that would be quite the adventure to slip in there.
So Freeman waited out there for the moon to rise and then slipped through an undisclosed weakness in the fence. Freeman told the reporter at The Sun that the mysterious seventh inscription was said to be carved into a canyon wall high above Papoose Lake. This is what he told The Sun.
I felt it was necessary to establish a link with the media just in case the wild rumors about trespassers disappearing were true. Unquote. But yeah, but
so Freeman had heard the stories about.
But by the way, just to give you an idea of the scale of distances we're talking about here, if he actually started out in the Specter Range, then and the inscription is in at Papoose Lake, that's about 34 crow miles northeast of where he would have started out at. And of course, his ground route would have been much more than 34 miles.
So Freeman had heard the stories of people entering Area 51 and never being heard from again. So this is what he went on to say.
Quote, the base is rumored to be protected by ex-Navy SEALs and Delta Force personnel. Should I vanish into thin air, a victim of excessive military exuberance, the government would have to extend a reasonable explanation, unquote.
Right. I mean, so this is why he's in touch with The Sun.
Yeah.
But honestly, most of Area 51 is just desert wilderness, freed of the nuisance of fences and military occupation signs of that. Jerry was kind of in his element.
Yeah. And just so you know, too, it's just like the government was basically relying on the hostility of the terrain and the environment to keep people out here. That's why he was able to do this, really, is because, you know, they just figured if anybody gets past a fence, number one, the fence around Area 51 will stop them. And then probably the desert will kill them long before they get there anyway. So, hey,
right,
why worry?
Exactly. You know?
But Jerry, on the other hand, had skills, right?
Yeah, he was a desert rat. And so in the early hours of Wednesday morning, Freeman climbed the fence. It's at the face of a place called Skull Mountain. It's literal.
Great name.
Find it out there. Knowing that a spring sat just on the other side. And this is when he sees it. These are his words by text message.
Quote, I stopped dead in my tracks. There before me, swallowing up the entire valley, lay an eerie, strange facility. I'm like, anything I'd ever seen before, unquote.
Freeman was absolutely shocked by this. This wasn't on the map. And it wasn't in satellite photos that he'd gotten either. No one knew it was there. And by the way, since this time, Freeman has been vindicated in his claims. So some people kind of received this with some skepticism back in 97, that he'd actually seen this massive facility. But it's there. You can actually see it on Google Earth now. So you can.
It's quite a huge thing. Although a lot of it, I don't know if they photoshopped it or what. A lot of it looks like large rectangular areas where there were facilities, buildings, something that have perhaps been removed. There's still buildings there. You can still spot in the area buildings and cars and stuff. And there's roads and streets and stuff like that. But the thing about it is I'm not really sure about is if it's been photoshopped by Google at the government's behest to take some details out of there. Maybe. But this is the most recent Google. I mean, 20 years prior to that, when this, in 1997, there might have been a full-on city there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And there might still be one there, but they, like I said, they've just photoshopped it heavily. I don't know. You can spot it. It's due east of Skull Mountain. So if you look for Skull Mountain, just go due east of there about, I don't know, five miles or so. And there's a big valley floor right there. You'll spot it, on Google.
Just to emphasize that a little more, people at the time wondered if Freeman just made this up. It sounded like a conspiracy theory. There's a massive complex, a massive city size, the facility of some kind, base installation of some kind out there that no one knew about at the time. Very few people knew about at the time. And now we know that at least something's out there that roughly tracks with what Freeman said he saw. So that when if you take anything Freeman says with any amount of skepticism, which I think you should, just be aware he was something like 20 years ahead of his time in talking about this and reporting it back to the Las Vegas Sun.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty interesting. He called it the City of the Dead because as big as it was, it basically seemed to have no activity and was functionally uninhabited.
Yeah. This is, I heard somewhere that this facility is actually what they used to use for assembly of nuclear weapons. And so it could have been that they had all kinds of stuff out there. Maybe they had massive factories full of centrifuges that were, enriching uranium, plutonium, whatever. And they were just manufacturing the weapons and putting them all together there. And since we're not really making any new nuclear weapons these days, maybe the whole thing has been you know, has been mostly dismantled. And it might be by the time he saw it in 97, it had been mostly shut down because we weren't doing a lot of constructive nuclear weapons then either. So maybe that's why it looks so dead to him, which doesn't mean it was abandoned. It just means that it was kind of, a lot of it was in mothballs.
Well, as we're going to see, it wasn't abandoned.
Oh, no, there were people there. There were definitely people there, and people with guns, too.
The problem that this base, this installation, presented to Freeman was that he was at this spring that he needed to go to. And in order to get where he wanted to go, the most direct route was going to take him right through this city of the dead place.
Yeah, it kind of sprawls. If you look at it, there's a valley, a flat valley floor down there, which is kind of, you know, he needed to walk up that valley to the northeast to get to Papoose Lake. And he could have gone around it, like, you know, by basically staying in the hills. That would have been much rougher or slower going.
I think I know the route you'd be talking about based on looking at it on Google Earth.
It's pretty rough, yeah.
I don't think I'd want to do that myself.
No, it's, obviously walking the valley floor is the way to go, you know, right? Yeah. So what's he going to do? Yeah, he makes a crazy decision. He decided he's not going to go around. He says he's going to go straight on through and just pass, you know, really close to this base, but just walk on by like he owns the place. I guess that's the plan, right? Well, he didn't quite do that, actually. He did a bit of skulking, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he wrote, as he wrote in The Sun, quote, "What would have been a 45-minute stroll became a five-hour ordeal of heart-stopping suspense. I felt like a bad actor at a prison break movie. Armed guards were everywhere, checking gates, circling structures, winding their way along the dirt roads that weaved in and out of my hiding places. I held my breath as powerful lights lit up the surrounding brush, raced for better cover when they faded." Unquote. Yeah, he's got a flair for the dramatic there
in
his writing.
He's a writer. He's book. He wrote a book, and it's never been published that I'm aware of.
That's too bad.
Yeah. I think he's a good writer. I think it'd be a fun book.
I think probably the government is like, you know, like come in there and just said, hey, you know, if you publish a book, we will kill you or something. or maybe he just couldn't find a publisher that was interested. I don't know. But.
Right. So what he finds is that the City of the Dead, as he termed it in his first text message to the Las Vegas Sun, was anything but empty. And so as he made his way slowly through this valley, he's dodging security forces, and Freeman notices that there's one particularly guarded building surrounded by a chain link fence. And he told the Sun that the window, which was too high to see into, emitted a radiant and pulsing glow.
The window, yeah, there was one window in this entire structure, right?
Yeah, I think it was the only window. Yeah, I think that's right. So that's kind of weird. He's like, what's going on in that building? But, you know, he didn't really have any time to figure this out. And anyway, we know Jerry Freeman by this point. This is not what he's there to do. He's not interested in the mysteries of Area 51. He's interested in the 49ers.
So, yeah.
He continued climbing, and he barely evaded detection by this security vehicle that he described as being oddly quiet, almost maybe like it was electric powered or something.
I was saying probably an electric golf cart, you know.
It seems like it. He described it as a truck, I believe, but
yeah,
it's not really like a golf cart, but yeah, it was really quiet, and it freaked him out how he expected to hear an engine. And so it seems like he's describing an electric vehicle.
Probably was, yeah.
And that almost didn't really exist.
No, there have been electric vehicles since the early 20th century, actually. They're just not wide civilian use, but you know, and certainly the government, you know, loves to waste money. So they probably just had GM put together some $500,000 electric pickup trucks just for use in Area 51 for some reason, you know, because, hey.
I guess, you know? But then why? I mean, I don't know.
I'm not sure. That's, you know, that is actually an interesting question. It might be that they actually had some of these really quiet vehicles because they wanted to do like perimeter patrols, and they wanted to be able to sneak up on people giving away the fact that, you know, this truck is, you know, coming up upon you. I mean, maybe that's why. I mean, that's just a possibility. I don't know. But,
I mean, so one theory I've read on, you know, it's from a Redditor, not from anyone who has any insight that I don't have or that you don't have, is that LANLL, Los Alamos National Laboratory something, that these guys had actually created a miniaturized nuclear battery, essentially, that they were driving around on, that is super top secret, possibly alien-derived tech.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I love it.
Well, you know,
he saw a truck drive by him that made no sound. I think that's pretty interesting.
That would be kind of weird. And what I was talking about, having a super quiet electric vehicle you could sneak up on people with, it almost got him. Mm-hmm. It snuck right up on him.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened was, you know, because he doesn't know all the roads that are on this base or in this area. So he had to run right alongside this, you know, it was a paved road. So it seems like it's a pretty main and important road to reach this spring that he had to get to. He needed that water. He's out there for 7 days. You can't carry 7 days of water with you.
That would be hard. Yeah.
Really heavy. So before he was home free, he had to walk right up to a barricade at the entrance of the northern end of this complex. And he wrote the Sun,
quote, "It was lit up like a Christmas tree and surrounded by a cacophonous din that grew louder the closer I came. The noise was coming from its power source, a generator, ponderous gasoline-driven behemoth on wheels working clockwise, enormous strobe lights alternately turned points of the compass into today before switching instantly to another location," unquote. So kind of like, it looks like there's some sort of temporary generator-powered lighthouse and searchlights, apparently, just to,
So what Freeman took away from this is that they were using these lights, these incredibly bright lights powered by this enormous generator, mm-hmm. to signal something or someone?
Maybe. So it wasn't, so he came away with the impression that these were not searchlights looking for ne'er-do-wells out there skulking in the sagebrush, but actually were signaling, maybe. And so maybe this was like a lighthouse that was used as a crude nav system by test aircraft at a Area 51.
But that's weird in and of itself. I mean, we can talk about this in theories. Like, there's easier ways to signal somebody with 1990s technology than just a big, bright strobe light.
I mean, there probably are, I guess. But, I'm thinking it probably did just sort of function as a lighthouse. So if you're out there in your test aircraft and you get a little confused, then this will clear things up for you.
Maybe
that's all it is. Because there have been famous instances of pilots getting lost and, you know, going into the drink or crashing their planes or whatever. And with your super expensive experimental aircraft, you don't want to do that, you know?
So as a redundant system, that makes sense.
Yeah. So maybe that's it. But again, that's just pure speculation on my part.
Yeah. Whatever the case was, Freeman had to run between these lights, and then he would have to just drop down to his belly and lay flat as they passed over him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until around 3 a.m. on Thursday morning when Freeman finally secured shelter in literally, and I think this is kind of cool, the same 19th century cabin the miners had made.
This is one of the ones that they built out of rock?
Yeah.
There's no trees out there to cut down and build a cabin.
There's no trees. I don't know. It probably, you know, if it had a roof, I think the roof was probably off of it at this point. It was probably just, you know, 3 to 4 rock walls that he was laying inside. But
they probably had
the same 49ers that he was there to see, and he knew he'd be out there.
That's kind of cool. Well, after all that he'd been through, that probably felt like pretty reasonable shelter. So it's kind of cool, though. So
that's right. So if they're just shining lights out there, being inside that rock shelter would have made good sense.
It's a good little hidey hole. Yeah, I'd take it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And so he spent the night in this place. And this is kind of cool because nobody had seen this place or slept in it since God knows when, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I think the last time it had been seen is the 1930s. I don't think anybody had been sleeping there since sometime in 1850.
Mm-hmm.
When the 49ers left. So
That's
a pretty cool thing for him. I think he was
like, for a guy like him, you and me, it'd be like blah, blah, blah. But you know, for him, since he was so into the history of the area, but especially the lost 49ers. And so, but the next morning, he gets a little few hours of shut eye, and now he's got to travel a little bit in daylight,
mm-hmm.
which is a little scarier for him, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, you mean, he's got this, he's got a real possibility of being caught by a random patrol or whatever.
I would be worried about like aircraft more than anything else. But
he was really worried about aircraft because if a guy's driving by in a truck, he can lay down. But if they fly over him, it's just sagebrush. He won't, you know.
Yeah, there's no way to. I assume he wore some nice sage colored clothing, but still,
it's going to be hard.
I'm sure he wasn't wearing bright orange clothes or anything.
No, but even so, a guy laying in a. You've been out in sagebrush country, right, Joe?
Yeah.
They fly a helicopter over low. They're going to see you land down in the sagebrush, even if you've got, you know, good clothing on.
Probably, you know, the only,
not necessarily, but probably, right?
No, actually the one thing I would say is if I was super paranoid about it, besides wearing sagebrush colored clothing, probably what I would do is I would actually cut myself a piece or two of sagebrush, an entire brush, and just carry it with me. So when I lay down, I can have it on top of me.
Right, just duct tape it to your back and then just lay down. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, this is an interesting thing that he remarked that he came across was, and this indicates to me that he might have been off course a bit because, but he came across a sign that said, danger, potential crater area, keep out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was thinking that he'd arrived at an old atomic test center. And as I said, just in the valley, just one valley over from Papoose Lake is where there were a lot of craters where they did test a lot of atomic bombs.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, though, what he was doing that far west, though. That means he was off course. Although,
okay, so that's interesting because I didn't interpret it that way, Joe. I took it that he knew where he was and he was on course, but these were sites that hadn't been documented.
Well, it might be that there are sites outside of that particular valley, and there probably were, actually. If you look at the valley, it's so pockmarked with craters. Maybe they ran out of space to touch off nuclear bombs, and so they went a little bit further east. So maybe that's it. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of these sites that I think – this is me speculating, but I'm pretty confident about this. Is that the sites that he was going on were not like trendy in New Mexico, where they just lit off a nuclear bomb and see what it would do, and we're like, oh, damn, that was – huge.
Well,
later in American atomic testing, they would bury bombs.
Yeah.
And this would stop the spread of fallout and it would help prevent the Soviets from being able to detect it and understand what Americans were doing. It was a great way to keep nuclear tests sort of quiet, but you could get most of the data that you could get from just letting one off in the air.
Yeah.
They did on, in the South Pacific and over Trinity, New Mexico.
Yeah. Well, basically
in Nevada.
Yeah. And actually those earlier tests gave them all the information they needed about what an atomic bomb, what it would do to a fleet of ships or what it would do to a town. They gave them all the information they needed about that.
But, exactly. So they were they were testing for really specific things by burying scale tests down in the dirt. And I have seen footage of some of this stuff that they did in the '60s.
Yeah. Like one of the big ones, you can actually see this one marked on Google Maps. It's called the Sedan Crater. And,
I know it. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
It's the biggest one in that valley. It's at the north end of the valley. And it was an underground test, and it moved about 11 million tons of dirt and left a big old crater there. Created a massive amount of fallout and left a little poisonous fallout over a massive area. I mean, they were pretty careless back in those days. They didn't really understand.
Right. So the Sedan Crater, just so people know, was one they were testing with the kind of insane idea that they could dig reservoirs with nuclear bombs.
Yeah. Now, there was talk back in the early days of this. I remember reading some books that were still around when I was a kid. They were talking about digging a new Panama Canal at sea level using nuclear bombs, which is a cool idea. I mean, they've dreamed about having a sea level Panama Canal since forever, eventually gave up on it when they realized just how much dirt that actually involved moving. I mean,
well, and the problem with we wanted to, irrigate the Columbia River Valley by dropping nukes in selected places along rivers like the Columbia and the Washougal and whatever else that would bound the Columbia River Valley to divert water and create reservoirs. That all sounds great till you realize we'd be just dumping radiated water onto those crops. And I believe that is that the fallout, not the effective nature of digging a crater with a nuclear bomb, was the reason that they abandoned this project.
Yeah, no, it's, there was a lot of sort of exuberance back in the early days nuclear weapons and stuff that there was all kinds of cool engineering projects they could accomplish with this stuff. And, but eventually reality set in, they realized, maybe not. So too bad.
Yeah, I mean, something that emits that much energy, right, that can do so much destruction that quickly is a powerful tool that could be put to really good use beyond just war.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's the radiation that'll get you.
Yeah, that's the friggin' problem. I know. It's sad. It really is a shame. But anyway, back to our thing here, though. We're talking about this area that he found, the potential crater area keep out sign that he saw. So beyond radiation, what he was really scared about, he was wondering if maybe there'd been an underground test. And that maybe there's one that didn't blast out a crater so much as just create a hollow pocket underneath that could cave in. So he was
right to worry about this. This was a very real thing they did in the mid and late 60s to avoid publicity and spies. They did do this. This was something that he could have stepped onto this area and then sunk into what he referred to as a plutonium hell.
Yeah, so he saw one likely looking area. It had no vegetation, so he...
Actually, Joe, I don't mean to be pedantic, but he saw more than one.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, but anyway, he took one of these areas of lacking vegetation and threw some large rocks into it, and he said that they just sank. It disappeared.
Yeah.
Into the sand.
Pretty weird.
Quicksand. I would not venture out onto that little patch myself, you know, but,
no,
yeah.
Well, he didn't want to go anywhere near it.
No, I wouldn't. So this is like, this is his third day, I think, right?
So his third day inside Area 51, this is when he saw these weird, I don't know what you call it, dry quicksand areas that were probably caused by radiation. It came to an end when Freeman found shelter inside a ship. It was actually a trawler.
I remember.
This is 1,000 something miles inland.
Yeah.
So it's just out there in the middle of the desert, just left there. I mean, this is like something out of the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
That's kind of cool. I like it. And I don't know
right?
I'm not sure how big this thing was. I don't know if it was an actual ship or just a fishing boat size craft.
It was a trawler, so it's probably a fishing boat size thing.
But yeah. I
mean, it probably wasn't small.
Yeah. No, definitely. It'd be kind of cool to stumble across something like that. I'd love it.
In the middle of the desert?
I know. It's awesome, actually. It's weird. Well, as long as there's no rattlesnakes in it, then it'd be a kind of a comfy place to bunk down for the night.
I think for sure there are rattlesnakes in it. But
anyway. You would think. I'd be expecting it, but...
But Freeman, he could deal with rattlesnakes. He was a desert rat. He knew it.
Oh, yeah.
So Freeman guessed that it had been slated for an atomic blast to see what it would do under nuclear conditions. Mm. This was actually not uncommon. They blew all kinds of stuff up.
Yeah.
And they tested nuclear bombs to see how it would affect, you know, houses and tanks. And
I just ships. Love it, though. But they, you know, they'd already tested it on actual ships in the water. So I love it. Some guys like, hey, guys, what about if we see what happens when a ship is just sitting out in the desert and it gets nuked? Okay.
I'm with you. To be charitable, maybe they were like, hey, we'll see what it would do if we wanted to drop a nuke near a fishing fleet to see if we could decimate a country's economy. I don't know.
It could have been maybe they wanted to see what would happen if they dropped a nuke near a shipyard, you know?
Boats
are out on dry land. I don't know, but it's just weird.
I mean, you know, it's science. You're just testing what you can test. But
it
would be really weird to just come across a fully intact ship through a fishing trawler out in the middle of Nevada's desert. So he's got the night in there.
That would actually be really cool. Although creepy and weird, but cool.
There's one of those out in Central Oregon. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Which one's that?
Yeah, if you're driving 26 and you come down off of Mount Hood somewhere before you drop down into Madras, some farmer has a pretty large, probably I'd say 30s, 40s era fishing trawler just sitting out in the middle of the high desert.
Yeah.
What he's doing with it. It's been there since I was a little kid, but it's just laying out there in the desert.
That is the great thing about farms and ranches is there's all this room to store all kinds of weird crap. You wouldn't believe the stuff.
Yeah, I thought he could scrap the metal or something, just dragged it out there.
Who knows? I mean, I've seen all kinds of weird stuff in barns.
Exactly.
But anyway, so he did spend the night on this ship, though, which is kind of awesome. And then the next day he crossed into the Nellis Base bombing gunnery range. Which sounds a little sketchy. I mean, because if a test of some sort were to occur, then you know you could certainly be killed. I mean, even if it's not a nuke, I don't think they're not testing nukes there these days.
But they test all kinds of other stuff.
They're out there doing bombing runs and stuff like that. That wouldn't be healthy. Right. That would not be healthy.
No, it would not be good for you if they decided to go test a bunch of conventional ordnance that
day. Yeah, but if there were alien craft in Area 51, he was getting pretty close to the area where they were being kept. At least according to the conspiracy theories.
I mean, that's how the lore goes. And he is in the dead middle of the most restricted areas within Area 51, within Nellis.
But then he's
in some dangerous territory. He's in some real trouble if they catch him here.
But then something happened to make his heart stop. Suddenly he realized that his phone, his fancy sat phone that he was using to communicate with the outside world, it had lost all of its signal.
Yeah.
He was truly alone.
And this is weird, right? Because what he'd been told is that as long as he had a clear path straight up to the satellites, he'd be able to use it. And it just stopped working.
Maybe the feds were jamming it. I don't know.
I'd imagine it's something like that.
But whatever it is, he's screwed. But unfortunately, we're out of time. So I think that we need to wrap this one up for today and maybe continue tomorrow with the rest of this story for you.
Yeah, I think we should.
Yeah. So we'll just leave you with that little cliffhanger. What can happen? Oh my God. Just the usual stuff. I mean, be sure to stay tuned for a moment or two to hear the lovely Tess tell you how to get a hold of us by email and social media and all that stuff. And of course, the usual plea to leave us a rating and a review wherever you're downloading or streaming your episodes from. We appreciate it. It helps us. Yeah, we like it.
It actually really does. And it helps us to be able to keep doing this and to expand our audience and get you better stories.
So absolutely.
Leave us a good rating and a good review.
Absolutely. So yeah, actually, if you want to go out and create new accounts and download twice and review twice, we won't fault you for that. No, not at all.
Oh, no.
Four times. Yeah, whatever. We do forgive you. But all right. So anyway, tune in tomorrow or sometime soon. And when we're dropping the next segment of this episode about the audacious Jerry Freeman and his adventures in Area 51.
Stuff's going to get wild for Jerry.
Oh, yeah.
In episode 2.
The shocking details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.